Okay, I think it's time for Dr. Yes. Mark to get started. We've had a three-week hiatus, I guess, last week he was away and the week before of Shavuot. And just, of course, a reminder, we have this week and next week, and then please God, Mark will be in Italy with our Torah in Motion first travel group in 3 years, and then we'll be in Portugal. So we'll be taking at least, six, seven weeks off. And then we'll please God resume toward the end of the summer. So, but we still have tonight and next week. So, Bakasha, Dr. Mark.
Yes. Glad to be here. And this is part 18, I believe. Happy to be here. And if you hear my voice, it's because of I do have COVID. I avoided it for 2 years, but what can I finally caught up to me. And truthfully, it's a bracha. I got it now. And it hasn't been that difficult. People ask me about my trip, so I'll spend a couple minutes. I'll show you some pictures, and then I do want to respond to some questions and comments. But Rabbi Kelman said we're resuming our trips, which we are in 2 weeks. God willing, 2 weeks from today, I'll be already in Italy. But I want to tell you about something that really annoyed me, which relates to the trips. And I guess if I don't know what to say, a do-gooder or something, I'll tell you what annoys me. And I know some people will disagree with me, but I'm going to show you what annoys me very much, because I take you, when you come on the trips, I take you to great places and I show you great things. In fact, those who will be with me in Italy, we're going to be entering the Venice ghetto in 2 weeks. And right as you enter the ghetto, right on the side, you have the actual declaration from the day the ghetto was established. Was it for almost 500 years ago, in which it states that the Jews, no one's allowed in here, and the Jews are not allowed to leave, and that they have to be here at night, and non-Jews are not allowed to enter, whatever. I forget the exact law shown. When you come with me to Vienna, smack in the middle of the main square, right at the top there, you have a terrible anti-Semitic thing. And all throughout Europe, you see these things. And these are important, I think, to see, to show. People today don't read them. They don't pay attention to them. Who can read the Latin going into the Venice ghetto, what it says about the Jews? But when you lead a tour, this is what you want to see. And this is important stuff. And you have in Germany, on a number of churches, you have many of the churches have, not many, a few of the churches have this. Here, hold on a second. Let me find you something and show you something here. Because you might have heard of the, I closed you up. Hold on. I closed you off. Let me just now share my screen again. The Ecclesia and Synagoga. So this is the big one in Strasbourg, a famous one. Although now it's in a museum and it's replaced by replicas, but you have at various churches, you have examples of this. So you have on the left, the church standing triumphant, and on the right, the synagogue, you know, blindfolded because the Jews are blinded to the truth. And she's, I guess, looks a little wanton, usually it's described. And this is important. And I don't think anyone today going into a church looks at that and is influenced by this, but it's important. Now you have the Jew sow. That is, this is another common image of the Jews suckling on a pig, because of course we don't eat pig. And you had this in woodcuts, and here you have it in Wittenberg, which is Martin Luther's church. As a historian, this is the sort of thing which really brings to life what, you know, for hundreds of years, people walking into a church saw and how it turned them against the Jews. Now, of course, today in a place like Germany, no one's going to church in all of Europe. They don't go to church anymore. But and no one who's anti-Semitic is being anti-Semitic because of an image of which they don't even know what it means anymore. And it says at the top, shame, I'm a faux rush. I mean, but this is important historically. So then you have, got to give kol hakavod, in my opinion, to the top German court, because you have, in the era of cancel culture, you have a, where is it? The description of, you have this Jewish individual who's been suing for years, I think it's described here, the plaintiff since 2018 to have the sculpture removed, just like they removed Confederate statues, to remove this sculpture because it's anti-Semitic and shouldn't be on. Now, despite the fact that the Jewish community, as it says here, created a site of remembrance, incorporating the sculpture. I don't know what to say. What can I say? It annoys me to no end that some Jewish person wants to remove the historical evidence of the anti-Semitism of Martin Luther in his own church. And it's not only a violation against history, it's a violation against, we should know the history of anti-Semitism. And it hurts my tours, because when I go to these places, I want to be able to point to it. And I don't want to, otherwise, who knows, they'll destroy it, they'll send it to a museum. It's like what they did with all the statues of Chopin in America. No one knows where they are. They put them away somewhere, and I don't like it. And it annoys me. It's a do-gooder, and I don't like these do-gooders, because and no one's going to the church anyway, believe me. They don't go to churches anymore. So what can I say? If they ever took them down, I'd be very, very annoyed. But in terms of tours, since a number of you asked, let me just briefly share something with you, and I do want to make a correction. You know, I spoke a lot about Gerba. I took my son. It was a nice trip, and I'm just going to show you a couple pictures here. You might recall when I've told you a number of times how the women don't go. I spent Shabbos again there. The women don't go to shul, and that's true. I did not see any women in any of the shuls on Shabbos. I asked people. They say no women go to shuls on Shabbos, but I also told you that one of the rabbis I said, who said, what do women have to do with shul? He said, told me that almost none will show up on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur either. But I was told differently. I was told this time that most do go to shul. So someone even said 90% he thinks go to shul on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Obviously not this rabbi's shul. And a number of them go to hear shofar. And but that's the only time. Also that in Purim. In fact, let me show you something. I even was in one of the new shuls, well, not new shul, a newer shul, but they even built an Ezra Snashim. Here it is, about 15 years ago, he showed me. So you see that even in Gerba, there's been some changes going on. But just briefly, here's some of the pictures I've shown that I think you might find interesting. The children, you got to be there on Shabbos to see hundreds of children. But I was interested also in the yeshivas, because there's a couple of yeshivas. So here's a picture in one of the yeshivas. Look at all these young kids. By the way, they don't wear tzitzis, most of them. As I told you, they don't. And I asked one of the rabbis when I was there. He said it's very hot, so I get it. But there's no expectation that to wear tzitzis. But here's some other pictures I took. Here you see a little kid, he does have tzitzis there, but others wouldn't. In the yeshiva here, it's only Kodesh, no limudei chol. There is another school where they can go and they can get some, they learn math and some science for like an hour a day. But some kids don't go. They just learn all Torah every day, except for, I think, Yom Kippur and I guess Tisha B'Av. But they're there on Shabbos. I went on Shabbos. They go to after shul, they go back to yeshiva every single day, 12 months a year. No no chofesh like we're used to. I'll show you some other things they took. Here's another picture. That gown is because the guy is wearing shorts. You can't wear shorts in yeshiva or when you're davening. Here's another. They took a picture of the Rebbe. They don't feel they need to dress like our Rebbes. That's the Rebbe. But these are guys are all learning. Let me show you one or two more pictures here. Here's another one. They don't divide it by grades. They divide it by levels of learning. And interestingly enough, they publicize, I don't know if I told you this ever, they publicize once or twice a year all the grades of all the students. I have a pamphlet I have, which has all the grades for each class. That will never happen in America because it's a violation of privacy. But there, you know, they feel that if, you know, you got a 60 or something in Gemara or in Halakha, that's going to embarrass you and you'll do better. So I asked, well, how could you do this? So they said, we're all family, so it's okay. So here's another Rebbe, and I even have, I think, a video of they review the Parsha. Here it is, each week in with the Trump. Yeah, I took a picture of that video. Let's see. So by the time they're older, they know the whole Torah by heart with the trup. When you go into the shul, you have to wear a gown if you don't have if you have shorts. So, for example, this is my son putting on his tefillin in one of the shuls. You have to wear this gown, which is strange. And there's 14 shuls in Gerba, including one in the shuk. So everyone can go for mincha when all the people who have their shops there. And the final thing I want to show you is just so you think it was all scholarship. And this is in a place called Zarzis. I also had shorts on, which is near Libya. So much so that my phone was being charged a lot of money. It wasn't on the Verizon plan because it was going through Libya, believe it or not. And but they have a whole community there, all Arabic speaking, the only place in the world where you get Arabic speaking children who are Jewish. And so you don't think it was all research and going out there, there's lots of fun. If we ever have a trip there, here I am in the Sahara. That was a lot of fun. So that's our brethren in Tunisia, in Gerba. Oh, it's very challenging, by the way, for Zionists, because although they're very big Zionists, they don't do tachanun. They do challah without a bracha on Yom HaTzimut. They don't do tachanun. The only place in the world, the day before Yom HaTzimut, and the day after Yom HaTzimut, 3 days. Yet they do not want any of their children going to Israel, because when after the state was declared and many of them went, they became Masorati or irreligious. And everyone in Gerba, all 1,200, are all Shomer Shabbos, all the children, because the only culture is the Jewish culture and the Arab culture, and then no one's going to be an Arab. But if you go to Israel, half these people, you see the typical Sephardic groups, they would just merge in with, Masorati Sephardim, but not really halachic. So, who can argue with them? It would happen. So they want all their kids to remain there, and the community's growing. It's the only Jewish community in the Arab world that's growing. And it's, like I said, it's something to behold. Okay, end of that. Let me go 5 more minutes. I have other things I want to get to, but I'll get to next week. I got to show you another thing. This is unbelievable. Because when I'm going to show you, I remembered it after the class. And I remember it was the big news, because the professor who it concerned was a well-known Christian Bible professor. Do you remember we spoke about Rabbi Dunner of Amsterdam? He had his commentary on the Talmud, where he has this unusual idea that certain passages of the Talmud were really meant to mock the rabbis, and then they got incorporated. And one of the ones he gave the example was is the case where a guy falls off the roof and hits a woman on the way down. They have sex, whatever. Now, I think this is, I don't sound to me think, the average standard view, and this, of course, is the correct view, is that the Talmud will sometimes give crazy cases. Not that it ever could happen, but they want to give the most extreme case. When we were in Gemara, when I was young, we'd ask questions about the cases, and the Rav would say, kasha from Misa. You don't ask a kasha from Misa. And the Gemara sometimes will give these extreme cases, and sometimes they give the extreme case because then it covers anything imaginable. But there was this professor who apparently for years he would give this case, this story, and he would use it to contrast, at least he claims, to contrast with Christianity, that in Christianity, if you have the intention but you don't do it, you still get credit. In Judaism, if you don't have the intention, it could still have significance. I forget the exact details. I actually think he probably was using it as an example to show the foolishness of Jewish law, that it deals with all these extreme cases. But if you can believe it, this is going back already to the 90s. It's not just something happening today. You think we only have snowflakes today. No, this woman at this very progressive, which they would call woke Christian seminary, protested that telling the story of the Talmud made her feel unsafe or abused or whatever it was, some nonsensical thing. And the professor was, he was disciplined. And he was, she charged that that by using the story, the lecture unreasonably interfered with academic performance. He was put on probation. He had to apologize, was told to get therapy and never to be alone with a female student, even though he had taught this passage for many years. Now, what's interesting is in all the articles about this, in one of the articles, they got to Ravaram Soloveitchik. He says, Ravaram says, the professor made an innocent statement and he quoted the Talmud correctly, says Ravaram Soloveitchik, a noted Talmudist and dean of Brisk Rabbinical College in Chicago. People should stop reading their own prejudicial ideas into the Talmud. It's libelous against the Talmud. But, I mean, this is interesting. Sexual or textual harassment. And then you have another one. Unintended sex leads to unintended fall. Professor files suit over charge of harassment. I just Googled it, and these were the three that came up because I remember it was a big case. But there's many, many others. Really, really crazy. Let me go two more minutes. In terms of Brich Shemei, I thank the person who commented on the video on YouTube and also Avi Katz for reaching out to Rabbi Jaffe, the head of Maimonides now, that they do not, in the days of the Rav, they do not say Brich Shemei. And anyone who wants more details on it, you can find it in in this book by Rabbi Binyamin Hamburger, Shorshei Minhag Ashkenaz, the first volume. He has a whole discussion of Brich Shemei, how originally this was not Ashkenazic Minhag. And you can read all about it. I have other things I want to get to, but I'll do this next class, including the Rambam. And I was right in my memory and not teaching a child umnus, a profession, why he doesn't record it. I was also in Paris on the way back. I'll share some halachic interesting things that I saw in Paris that I think you'll find interesting, because we take for granted just the opposite, because we don't live in a place where it doesn't get sun doesn't set till almost 10 o'clock at night. Many people, because we live, maybe at the end of the class I'll get to it, they assume certain things about Jewish life because they live in a time zone where things are relatively easy. And I also want to get to, Rafal Breuer and his commentary on Shir Shiri. We'll get to that as well. But it's already time, so I want to pick up now where we left off. Especially since I do want to wrap up to a certain extent, if I can, by next class, because then I'm going to be off for a while, for a couple of months. But let us begin. If you recall, and if not, I encourage you to go to the videotape. And as Warner Wolf used to say, Warner Wolf was together with my father in school in Washington, D.C. But if you remember him from the news, you can go to the YouTube or the Torah in Motion and you can listen to it. We're in the middle of dealing with Abraham Geiger and his approach. So let me pick up just by saying that according to Geiger, and he's clear about this, in the battle between Pharisees and Sadducees, everyone wants to be a Pharisee, the Orthodox, and that's what they're called now, the Orthodox are the modern Sadducees. Just like the Sadducees died out because they couldn't change with the times. When the temple was destroyed, they were so attached to the temple, they couldn't adapt, and therefore they disappeared. So too, the Orthodox, or the traditionalists, now that we're entering into a new era of emancipation and Jews are being welcomed into the modern state, the traditionalists can't live like this. They can only live in a ghetto when they control people and don't allow them live the way they want to live. And therefore, he had no doubt that the Orthodox would not be able to survive. Now, you could say that Geiger has been proven wrong. Orthodoxy has survived. And I have no doubt that if Geiger was alive today, he'd be quite surprised that there's still a vibrant Orthodox community that pass it on to their children. And yet, in a sense, you could look at it the other way and ask, really, has Orthodoxy really survived in a significant sense? If you take the United States, and what are the Orthodox, we're told? 12, 13, 14% of the American Jewish population? That's not really very successful. Now, it's true that as every year goes by, the Orthodox percentage grows, and both in terms of absolute numbers and in terms of percentage. But much of that is due, obviously the Hasidim have a lot of children, but in terms of percentage, really, because the larger community is just disintegrating and disappearing. I don't know if in retrospect, if a 15% survival rate of the Orthodox, which then will become the Jewish community to a large extent, in certain places it already is the majority, like in Baltimore. But, maybe Geiger could say that's not such a success. But be that as it may, Geiger did not even think that you could have any vibrant religious communities in modern times. And I mean, this Hirsch agreed with Geiger on this major point, as we'll get to it, that traditionalist Judaism of the sort that Geiger was referring to could not survive in modernity. That's going to be Hirsch's major point. And it became clear very quickly from 1800, where in a place like Germany, traditional Jews were the majority, till 1850, where they were the minority in all the big cities. It happened within two generations. That showed that, according to Hirsch, that the rabbinic leaders had missed the boat and were not living in accord with Torah and Derech Eretz, which means that the Torah has to confront and be a controlling factor in every civilization. If you're living in the 19th century Germany, like you're in 18th century Berlin, Warsaw or Vilna, then there's no way Judaism is going to survive. So we'll see that a figure like Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is going to be the biggest adversary for a Geiger, because he shows that, contrary to what Geiger says, that traditional Judaism can survive. But both Geiger and Hirsch agreed that the old form of traditional Judaism could not survive. Geiger drew one conclusion from it, that therefore we have to abandon traditionalism in its entirety. And Hirsch drew the other conclusion. And once Hirsch's method gets going, there's very little attrition. In fact, Geiger felt so threatened by Hirsch's approach that he wrote a review of the 19 letters in opposition. So what is the basis of Judaism, therefore, for Geiger? If it's not Jewish law, if you ask traditional Jews, of course, it's halacha. Well, he believes that Judaism has, I guess we can call it, a creative spirit. Maybe that's the best way to put it. Everything that's been part of Judaism, including halacha, arose from this creative spirit. The fact that halacha doesn't speak to us anymore doesn't change the fact that it arose from the creative spirit. But for Judaism to survive, every generation needs a new creative spirit. So the idea, remember, it's not reformed Judaism. That's like, happened in the past. No, it's reform. It continues. It's reform. It continues to change. And although even someone like Geiger and the early reformers could never imagine what reform Judaism became, they did recognize that moral values change. And therefore, it doesn't make sense, for instance, when years ago someone wrote an essay against the changing view of reform about the homosexuality and said, what would Solomon Frihoff and Claude Montefiore say if they were alive today? Because it's not important what they would have said it's not important what someone 100 years ago or 75 years ago were to say. It's important if he'd actually be living today, not if he'd get up from the grave, because the attitude is that morality changes, our understanding of morality changes. They progress. Now, how far do you progress? Okay, let the reformers duke that out. But Geiger puts a great deal of emphasis on this factor, the notion of the times, that religion has to listen to the outside world. It can't live in a vacuum. Judaism changes. It has to change. And that's where his scholarship is so important, because he's not just some preacher preaching about how it has to change and we have to listen to the outside world, because the outside world is like a form of revelation. There's this dialectic here. It's not that we see how things are, people looking for freedom, things like that, and that speaks to us, and we look in our tradition and we see God's word in the past, that sort of stuff. It's not like you can open up the Torah and actually point to this verse or that verse, but it's a dialectic of what we hear. And remember, the Torah comes from the people itself. That's where it comes from, someone like Geiger. But Geiger is not just some preacher, like I said. Geiger is a scholar, a great scholar, and it's going to be his understanding of ancient Jewish history in particular, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he's going to focus on them, that's going to enable him to legitimize reform from a traditional sense in his mind, that is to show that it's carrying on a tradition. It's not just a break with tradition, something new. He could have said that this is reform, this is the past. There were reformers who said this, that this is how we used to live, but now we understand we have to live differently, and therefore it's a break, and now we're going to create a new type of religion for our people. No, Geiger sees, he wants to create a historical link, and he does this through his scholarship to legitimize reform, because now reform is authentic. And his views in this are seen most clearly in a book that he wrote, which is a work of scholarship, but is more than a work of scholarship. You can get it, I see, on Amazon, a reprint, even in paperback, The Urschrift und Übersetzungen der Bibel in ihrer Abhängigkeit von der inneren Entwicklung des Judentums. So the original source and the translations of the Bible and its connection to the in the development of Judaism. So what is this book? Well, it's a study of the Targumim and of the Septuagint and what we can learn about how Judaism developed based on this. We all know that there's Targums. Targum is the Aramaic translation of the Torah. You open up any Mikros Gadolos, you have Unkos, but then you have other Targums. You have Targum in Navi, you have Jonathan, Targum Jonathan. You have Ketuvim, a Targum. They call it Jonathan. It's not. And on the Torah, you have a Targum. Scholars refer to it as Pseudo-Jonathan because it's called Targum Yonatan, but we know Yonatan didn't write it. In fact, the reason it's called Targum Yonatan is because originally it was Tuf apostrophe Yud, and the printer thought that was Yonatan, but actually it refers to Yerushalmi, Targum Yerushalmi. And there's a fragmentary Yerushalmi. We have another full Yerushalmi. It's called Targum Neofiti, because that's what the name was given, was discovered at the Vatican. So we have a number of Targumim. Other than Uncleus, the others are more expansive, very midrashic. We have the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Torah. We have the Vulgate, obviously, the Latin translation. We have, in terms of ancient versions, we have the Samaritan text. And we also have a testimony of ancient texts in the Talmud, in the Midrash, other sources. So there's a lot to work on in this regard. But what Geiger is going to tell us is that there's a whole history to Judaism that in a certain measure we can see through these ancient texts. No one really had argued this before to the extent that Geiger did. I mean, he's speaking in terms of grand theological ideas. It is true, as we'll see, that even before Geiger, it had been argued that the scribes, the Sofrim, and even the Masoretes, we're going to see about the Masoretes, the ones who punctuated the Torah, had altered the original text. We'll talk about Tikkun Sofrim. But Geiger's going to go much further because he's going to offer a complete discussion of this phenomenon. And he's going to show us that he thinks that there were evolving views, theological views, religious views, and we can see the remnants of them in the various versions of the Targumim, and this affects theology. It also affects halakha. Before Geiger, most people said, well, these are mistakes. These are errors, copyist errors or translation errors. But Geiger said, no, these are not errors. These are not mistakes. These are different halachic positions, different ideological positions that we see in the ancient texts. And of course, the upshot of all this is going to be that Judaism is constantly evolving, constantly being changed, because the rabbis are the ones, according to Geiger, who basically pushed out all these texts and these ideas for their own reasons, as we'll see. In fact, he says that in these early texts, we see the struggle between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and as well as all sorts of other political and religious struggles. But with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, then the Pharisees are in charge, and they were able to set the text of the Torah. They were able to remove all these other types of Judaism and create one text. So, but the Septuagint reflects a completely different type of Judaism. It's not just it's a mistake, and all the other versions as well. and therefore Onkelos, for instance. That's the Pharisaic Targum. But what about the Septuagint? Septuagint is the Greek translation. It's the Bible of the Greek Orthodox Church. Well, the Old Testament of the Septuagint, Geiger says, has a different halacha, which means that it was working with a different text. And Geiger thinks that what we have, our text, what we call the Masoretic text, was actually altered for ideological reasons to reflect the new halacha. Namely, the Pharisees created a new halacha. And of course, Geiger's a new Pharisee, so he can also create a new halacha. That's why this isn't just scholarship, but this is scholarship to make a point, to prove something. If you can show that the Pharisees were engaged in reforms, that is, they didn't like earlier halachot, and therefore they reformed them and came with their own halachot, and then they altered, they changed the text of the Torah to reflect their own halachot, well, then Geiger is part of historical continuum. And he can do the same. In fact, he would say that the Septuagint preserves the ancient or the authentic reading. By the way, since I just thought of this as I was preparing today, the Supreme Court is going to come down with its ruling. It could be released tomorrow or the next day. I mean, we sort of know what it's going to say. Well, I shouldn't say that because you never know, at least based on the leak, that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned. And this has led the last few weeks to great disputes in the Orthodox world. I'm thinking of Torah in Motions in Canada, so maybe they don't feel the weight of this moment, because I'm thinking maybe you should have a class or two or discussions on it, because on the one hand, you have people like Rabbi J. David Bleich coming out like an evangelical preacher saying that the Orthodox Jews should feel a debt of gratitude to the Catholic Church for fighting this battle that we have been on the sidelines on. And on the other hand, you have Rabbi Jeremy Weider, the complete other side, gave a very interesting interview on the right, Scott Kahn. He was with Brandeis with me, his podcast, The Orthodox Conundrum, in which Rabbi Jeremy Weider very eloquently explains why it's in Orthodox Jews' interests, Dafka, to support Roe versus Wade, and how overturning this would be a terrible thing. And I guess you have everyone in the middle. In fact, I was shocked. There's an audio from a few years ago of Herschel Schechter. And I don't think there's anyone more liberal about abortion than Herschel Schechter. He's talking about abortions in the ninth month for good reasons. And that's the Tzitz Eliezer says until the seventh month. And Rav Schechter is saying he doesn't understand. It's why you can't go to the ninth month if it's an important reason. And he's talking about a case with a Beis Yaakov girl and with the Rabbanim in London. They got pregnant, and I think it was a Beis Yaakov girl, and they allowed her to have an abortion. But then he says into the ninth month, I know a lot about the issue. As far as I know, there's never been a posek, unless it's a matter of life and death for the woman, but not for these other concerns, to have an abortion in the ninth month. I was a little shocked to hear Schechter say it. But so I can tell you that in the Orthodox world, the views go from all the way on the right to all the way on the left, and all arguing from Torah sources and what should be our position. So if I could put my two cents in, I think maybe Rabbi Kelman should... it's not an issue in Canada, I think, but it's a big issue in America, and it's coming down soon. Well,
we have one of the most liberal abortion laws in the world. Yeah. I don't think there are no restrictions on abortion, as far as I know, in Canada. There was big debates. Henry Morgenthaler, those who know, was an Auschwitz survivor. He went to jail a few times because he was giving abortions, you know, when they were illegal in Canada. And now it's totally legalized. There's no law restricting it. And, I'm with you. I'm very much in favor of Roe versus Wade. I'm with Jeremy Weider. It's good for the Orthodox community to have Roe versus Wade, but that's a whole other story.
Remember, Roe versus Wade ended it at 6 months. It's not like in Canada where in the ninth month or something you can do
I don't know that there's any prohibition in Canada.
There's not. You can do it into the ninth month.
Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of Canadians here on the on tonight, but I think there's the Supreme Court. There was a law, and the Supreme Court threw it out years ago, and Parliament has never passed an abortion law as far as I know. And it's made a lot of news here. It's been a lot in the newspapers. Everything, you know what they say, when America sneezes, we catch a cold in Canada. So that's the expression.
Now listen, when a woman's 9 months pregnant and she can give birth tomorrow and you permit an abortion.
I didn't say permit, I'm just saying it's anyway, okay,
but so why do I mention this?
By the way, that was when somebody asked before we're going to do medical ethics. So that's one of the things we want to discuss next time we do medical ethics. We'll discuss it. Okay, I'll let you
talk. So why do I mention this? I mention this for one reason, because just to show you the sort of thing that Geiger was speaking about, I think I'd give an example. I'll give a few other examples. And then I was preparing the examples. I'm thinking, well, the abortion's a great example of what Geiger's speaking about in terms of a different halacha expressed in the Septuagint, where it isn't just an error or a mistake. His point is it's a different halacha, which has then been pushed out. And so what's the example? Well, here's the example. And it's very in Yana de Yoma. So in the book of Shemos, no, this is actually the wrong. Chapter 21. You know, it's always curious as to the title of this book, Exodus in Hebrew, because we have another book, Numbers, Bamidbar. So a lot of people like to be technical and they say, well, it's not Bamidbar, it's Bimidbar. But really it's Bamidbar because you're not, it's only Bimidbar if it's a construct. If it's not a construct, it's a one word, so it's Bamidbar. And I always made that point, and that point has been made in another. So you say we're reading Parshas Bamidbar. On the other hand, but then you have a problem though, because Shemos, the plural of Shem is Shemot. It's only Shemot
when it's... He comes from Borough Park. I know his family.
But hold on. I gotta
close. I know his family. Yeah.
Hold on. I gotta close sound. The construct is Shemot, but without it, there's a Seire under it. So I don't know what it should be then. So maybe if it's Bamidbar, it should be Shemot. And if it's Shemot, it should be Bamidbar. Be that as it may, Chapter 21, verse 22, very famous verse. It's the classic verse on the abortion issue. V'chi yanatsu anashim, if men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, that is, they cause her to miscarry, and yet no harm follow, v'lo yaason. So what's the punishment? Anoshi yanesh, he'll be surely fined, according to what the woman's husband shall lay upon, the husband will make a claim, and then the judges have to determine it. And then it goes on, if any harm follows, it's life for life, eye for eye, etc. So we know that the rabbis don't interpret eye for eye literally, but life for life is literal, eye for eye, because they say, who knows whose eye's better than the other. But this is important for the abortion issue, because we see that... If the woman is killed, we say a life for life. But if her fetus is killed, we don't say life for life. It's we treat it as property. Now, it doesn't mean it's property. It's certainly more than property. But how else? That's the only thing you can do. If you knock out someone's eyes, your eye is obviously much more important than property. But how else can we compensate you? So we see from here that it's not regarded as a human life before birth. We don't know what it's regarded from this pasuk, but it doesn't have the same standard as a human life. And all Jewish discussions of abortion begin with this. And with the exception of Ramosha Feinstein, everyone assumes, therefore, by definition, it can't be murder because it's not a human life. Ramosha Feinstein's position is the most extreme, I think, ever offered on abortion, which is unusual because he's known generally as one of the mekilim in halacha in these weighty cases, but very stringent on, in fact, on the on Rav David Lichtenstein's podcast on this issue, where he had Rav David Cohen on, who had more of a middle of the road position. Rav David Cohen really rejects Ramosha and says Ramosha is out of the mainstream and on this. So I found that interesting. Okay, so what does this have to do then with the point? Well, if you look at the Septuagint, here's the verse 22. If two men strive and smite a woman with child, and her child be born imperfectly formed, then he shall be forced to pay a penalty as the husband may lay upon him. He shall pay with evaluation. But if it be perfectly formed, he shall give life for a life. Wait a second, verse 23. Verse 23 is if any harm follows. We're talking about harms follows to the woman. And the previous verse says, if they hurt a woman with child so that her fruit departs and no harm follows. That is, no harm follows for the woman. And yet here it says, they interpret ason, as not meaning no harm follows, a son is formed. So whether it's, if it hasn't been formed completely, then you pay the penalty. Today you might say viable. But if it's perfectly formed, which you might today say, if the baby's viable, then it's life for a life. Well, that's according to this understanding, the Septuagint, a fetus is a human life. And it's only a human life, not a conception, like the Catholic Church says, which wasn't always the position of the Catholic Church. It wasn't St. Thomas Aquinas' position, by the way, but today is the position from conception. But according to this reading in the Septuagint, at when the child is formed, and you can understand why people would say that, because when a child comes out, you could see it looks like a human, so it's a human. So is this a mistake? Many scholars have argued this is a mistake. The Septuagint misunderstood it. No, Geiger would say, and I don't know if he actually deals with this passage, but this is his whole point in his book, in dealing with changes in Halakha and Septuagint, that no, this is not a mistake. This is a different tradition. This is a different understanding of the verse. That's what Geiger's whole position is. And I'm going to give you some other examples where Geiger does this. Actually, I'm going to not deal with Halakha as much as I'm going to show you examples in theology, which I think you'll find interesting. Now, Geiger is correct about one thing. That is, the text of the Torah was in a, a more fluid state. There were different versions. What do we say about the Masoretic text? I don't think anyone can say that with absolute certainty this is the authentic text. I mean, the Midrash and the Sifra and I think it's in Devarim Rabbah, I believe, already speaks about how in the days of Chazal they had a dispute among the Pharisees. That is, they didn't know what certain verses meant, and they went by the majority. So we know that there were different versions, and Alpi Halacha, that's all you can do. You take the majority, you go Alpi Rov, and that determines the Halacha. So we're not bound dogmatically to deny the fact that there were other versions. We have different versions in medieval times even. And we have from the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you believe in halachic system, then you believe that, I'm not saying you believe that it's has to be the authentic text given to Moshe Rabbeinu, but you believe in the halachic system, just like we believe in halacha is decided a certain way. The whole story of the Oven of Achnai, Tanosh Achnai, the halacha is being decided incorrectly, wrong. That is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intention, as it were, is different. But no, lo b'shamayim hi. So this is how we decide, and that's... And you can look at my book, Limits of Orthodox Theology. I quote all the Rishonim and Acharonim who deal with this. And that's not controversial. That's not controversial at all. But what's interesting in Geiger and is that he's not arguing that the Septuagint reflects, let's say, a mistaken text or a different version that just arose, idiosyncrasies of translators. No, he's saying that these reflect a completely new, different halachic system or different theological system. That's scholars today don't take this seriously. His point, I'm saying, especially his point dealing with that this often reflects Pharisaic Sadducean rivalry. First of all, now we know that it's really not between Pharisees and Sadducees. That's not the whole story. We have the Dead Sea sect. We know that things are much more complicated. And there's, as far as I know, and we have someone who listens often who's an expert in this area, so I'll let him weigh in because I'm hardly an expert on this. And he can tell me, he's emailed me many times. Tell me, please, because I'm aware of no evidence that the sectarians would manipulate the text of the Torah to put forth their own theologies. If there is examples of this, please let me know. But Geiger does argue that the ancient translations not just change text to agree with their halachic approach, but also in order to accord with the theology that was prevalent at the time. And not just the translations, but later it's not really the punctuators, because this goes back already to the rabbis, that they changed the pronunciation of words, because it was only vocalized with the actual vowels later, in order to bring it into line with theological ideas. So let me give you an example of what Geiger says. on this. And you know, Shadal Shmuel David Atzato says something, basically says the same thing. So they were both coming across the same, saying the same idea. I'm not really sure what to make of this. If you look in Shmos, chapter 34, verse 23, we have a pasuk we know well. Shalosh pamim bashana yera kol zechorcha es paneha adon Hashem al kei Yisrael. Three times in the year shall all thy males appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. What Geiger says, and again, he wasn't the first to do so. Shadal Shmuel David Atzato. Now Shmuel David Atzato is a traditionalist. He's one who attacks Geiger, but he's a traditionalist with some unusual ideas. On the one hand, he's also a big defender, Shadal, the greatest defender of the unified Isaiah. But he was not afraid to put forth, provocative ideas. Both of them say as follows. And Geiger, you know, Shadal just has it as a throwaway. Geiger has this as a major point. What Geiger says is as follows. That originally this pasuk must have read, Shalosh pamim bashana yira kol zechorcha es panei ha'adon Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Geiger says that it doesn't make sense to read it grammatically, yira kol zechorcha. And he gave another example. And he quotes look at the very next verse, verse 24. The translation of this is, when you go up to appear before the Lord thy God three times in the year. Geiger says it has to be originally have read, Ba'aloscha liros es panei Hashem al-kecha. And he gave one other example of this, more than one, but this is the one I recall. If you look in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Aleph, verse 22, it says, V'chana lo asa, chana did not go up, ki amra le'isha, for she said to her husband, Adi gamel hanar, until the child be weaned, v'ali osiv, and when I will bring him, v'nir'ah es p'nei Hashem, v'yashav sham ad olam. Now this, that he may appear before the Lord and there abide forever. So Geiger says it clearly did not originally say v'nir'ah et p'nei Hashem. He says that's not grammatical. Nir'ah here is used in the Nifal, passive. He said it had to have originally said v'aviosi, thou will bring him, v'nir'ah es p'nei Hashem, and we will see God. Now this doesn't mean, Geiger holds, that the ancients thought that you could see God. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that they were more comfortable expressing themselves in this way, that we're going to go up to the temple and we will see God. What it means is that we'll see the glory of God in the sacrifices in the temple. But Geiger says when you get by the, at some time during the Second Temple period, the Chachamim saw this as blasphemous to read it as we will see God, because of course you can't see God. And therefore they changed it to Yera'eh, to, you know, will appear, will come up. That's what Geiger says. He brings another example, which I think is really doubtful. Here in Vayikra 9:4, he says, we'll skip that. I don't need to get to that for now. So that's an example that Geiger says that the sages, they had a reading tradition. They thought the reading tradition was blasphemous, so they changed the reading tradition. Now, I guess you could argue that this is not even problematic from an Orthodox standpoint, because you could say that the sages were returning to what it should be, where you could say that it was the sages were correcting a mistake, that in theory you could speak this way, but because the people could be led into anthropomorphism, therefore it is no longer appropriate to speak this way. So I don't know if fundamentally it's like an anti-traditionalist position, because you could make such an argument, but it clearly is not a traditional position. Although Shaddal himself says that this is what happens, that the Chazal, in order to ensure the purity of people's beliefs, change the vocalization from what originally it was. Because now you have examples of this in my book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology. I discuss Tikkun Sofrim. We do have a concept of Tikkun Sofrim where, according to many versions, we have different texts that speak about Tikkun Sofrim, that is the Sofrim altered text. Now, in some of these, it doesn't mean it literally. It's just a euphemism. But in other texts, and I'm talking texts of the Midrash and the Aruch, classic texts, It's stated that the Sofrim, that's, let's say, Ezra or Anshei Knesset Gedolah, actually changed the text of the Torah, and they had the authority to do so. Now, I realize that Moshe Feinstein called this heresy, and others have said that this can't be true, and that even Rav Zaira de Rossi, I'll talk about him on my trip to Italy, the Mori Naim, says that this is heresy and it can't be true. But the problem is we have this in multiple texts, and we don't just have it in multiple texts. We have it quoted in Rishonim. We have it quoted in Rashi. I'll show you in Rashi here, or at least in a version of Rashi, which most people assume to be the correct version, chapter 18, verse 22. It says, "Va'yifnu misham anashim ve'yachus sodom of Avraham odenu omed b'fnei Hashem." Avraham remained standing before Hashem, and in this pasuk, Rashi says, it should have said, that Hashem is still standing before, because Hashem came to Avraham. So what do you mean Avraham's still standing? It should be Hashem still standing there. But it's a scribal emendation. And in the early versions we have what's in the brackets here. Asher hafchu zal lichtov came, which means that the scribes, they turned it around. And we have a number of other examples of Rashi where he quotes these texts. So he seems to have taken it literally. These words, Asher HaShafu, which are in all the Mikros Gedolos, they were removed from the Art Scroll Mikros Gedolos, by the way. So if you want to know more about Tikkun Sofrim, as I said, it's definitely in opposition to the Rambam's eighth principle. On the other hand, because you have the later figures altering the Torah. On the other hand, we have a number of discussions where people explain why this is the case, and that the Anshei Knesset Gedolah and Ezra is referred to. If it says that the Torah wasn't given through Moshe, it could have given to Ezra. That Ezra had the authority as like a Shas Hadchak sort of thing, Eis Lasos. That it was important to remove this anthropomorphism, and they tell us. It's not like they get rid of it and they pull the wool over our eyes. They tell us that this is a Tikkun Sofrim. So you know, sages, you know this is a Tikkun Sofrim. But the masses, when we read it to them, they'll see it one way. Again, it's not in line with what most people are taught today, but it's found in authoritative sources. And Shaul Lieberman in Hellenism, Jewish Palestine, says that all attempts of Zaria de Rossi and all the rest to try to get rid of this other tradition to create one tradition are incorrect. There's actually two traditions. There's one tradition that Tikkun Sofrim means euphemism, and not that you should read the text as if it was an emendation, and the other text though takes it literally. And as I said, you can look at Limits of Orthodox Theology. I'm not here to justify it or give the theology. I'm just saying it's there, and we have to deal with it. In fact, Ibn Ezra took it literally, and Ibn Ezra rejects it. Ibn Ezra says he rejects these midrashim that speak of a real Tikkun Sofrim because it says it's impossible. He says they're just wrong, but he acknowledges that this is what they thought. In any event, by pointing to these examples and things, including the things that were regarded as Tikkun Sofrim, Geiger believes that he can show that what you have, if you look in the Bible, is an evolution. And there's a history of the text. And through the history of the text, you can see the history of the religion. And that's the major point he wants to show in this book. There's other things which we'll get to next class, because what does reform mean? Where do you take reform? Is everything on the table? We'll get to that. And then Geiger's views of, is there a Jewish people then? I mean, all this sort of thing. But this is an example of what we call engaged scholarship, showing how in the past something happened through scholarship, and then it should lead us to do it in the present. Now, from a traditionalist standpoint, B doesn't follow from A, because I can acknowledge, let's say, that I'll follow the Aruch. The Aruch is an important source. When I go to Rome next week, I'm going to talk about the Aruch, because he comes from Italy. The Aruch takes Tikkun Sofrim literally. Now, what was the Aruch's theology? I don't know what his theology was. He obviously gave Ezra a certain role. It's not, he doesn't have to agree with the Rambam. Nathan. I just don't know offhand his dates. So he's 1035 to 1106. So he's a contemporary of the Rambam. So he doesn't have to follow the Rambam. I don't need to justify the Aruch. The Aruch is significant also for halachic reasons. The whole idea of psikeresha do nichale, that it's mutter, quoted by Tosfos. He's not just a dictionary. He's also a Rishon. And he took Tikkun Sofrim literally. So you can say, if you want to take Tikkun Sofrim literally, even though it's not like a mainstream view, fine, Ezra could do this. Anshe Knesset Gedolah could do it. That doesn't mean that we could do it, but that's not Geiger's approach. Geiger didn't have this sense of awe and bittul das, I guess, to the sages. If the sages of the past could do it, well, I'm a sage also, and I could do it as well. And the thing about Geiger was, as we'll see, with the problem with the destruction of the temple is that everything was fossilized. He wants to bring back the way it was with the Pharisees when Judaism could move. And his point, as I mentioned many times, is that we now are going to be the real Pharisees. But it is interesting, and it's for another time of discussion, to look at these examples that Geiger brings of, let's say, altering the readings. Must we insist dogmatically that this is incorrect, or even from a purely traditional standpoint, leaving aside Shaddai, can you argue that, can you agree? I don't know. You have to ask the Orthodox theologians that, yes, originally that was the reading, and Chazal had the authority to change the pronunciation precisely because of a fear of anthropomorphism. And maybe you can even say in Messianic days, we'll bring back the original reading. I can certainly see traditionalist sources having approach like that, because there's other, I don't know those examples, but I know of similar sort of examples where they offer things like this. And it would be interesting to develop if, at least in some of these ideas, you can accept some of the arguments of Geiger without then accepting the conclusions. Because, like I say, B doesn't follow from A. If Ezra or Chazal could change something, they created Torah Shabbat Peh. So, I mean, are you going to say because Chazal made a takana, or Chazal said we can't do this? Well, if the sages said that you can't do this on Shabbos, well, that shows that today we can say you can do it, because we're sages like they're sages. That would just, well, that's exactly what Geiger's going to do. That would mean that the whole oral law, that would mean that the whole, our whole religion, much of which is based on the rabbis, has now been overthrown, because, well, if the rabbis did it, then we can do it. And, for traditional Judaism, obviously the two don't follow. The rabbis had the authority to do certain things. But we'll leave that, I think. Let me take the questions and comments. The one thing you can't deny, no one can deny it, is that Geiger is a chacham. His greatest opponents had to acknowledge that some of his things were just, people just hadn't thought of it before. So someone, thank you, pointed out that 1516 was the year the Jews were confined to the ghetto, which I had forgotten. So so we're over 500. Someone disagrees that they're anything but do-gooders. Ah, no, he agrees with me. Anything but do-gooders. Yeah. You know, this is, at other times, it's more controversial. Those of you who've been to Europe, and you'll see it in Italy with me next week, if you're with me, the Stolpersteins on the ground. You find them all over, and I like them very much. I think they're a great way of memorializing. But in Munich, the leader of the Munich community, or one of the leaders, is staunchly opposed. She's a survivor, and she thinks it's disrespectful to walk on the names. So although I think it's a mistake and it's a great way of commemorating. But I can see that. But with regard to the old images in a church, today they are only historical images. And, you know, it's interesting because I don't know how consistent I am, because it didn't bother me when I took the Confederate statues down, even though I'm a historian, maybe because I'm not an American historian. I know my father, when he drove up, I think it was in Richmond, you know, historically, it's interesting to see them. On the other hand, you could say perhaps that the Confederate statues are not just antiquarian interests. People actually today are motivated by the idea of Confederate flags on cars, as well as the fact that, let's be realistic here, the Confederate generals and all these Confederate, they were traitors to the country. It's very unusual to have statues in a country of traitors, leaving aside the whole racial angle here. So that's something else. But I will be very disappointed if they remove, as MH later said, they're not good do-gooders. If they remove that these things, it would make my trips less interesting. Suzanne asked, what are the girls talking? Now, I didn't take any pictures of the girls in Gerba because, first of all, it's Friday. The girls don't have school on Friday. I guess they're taught to help out at home. But the girls go to a different type of school. It's called Canfe Yona. You can just Google it or email me. I'll send you the link. The Wall Street Journal even had a whole video on this about 2016, so 6 years ago. They're taught languages, English and French, and it's going to create a culture gap because they're secularly educated and they're taught Hebrew. Everyone's taught Hebrew, by the way. Everyone speaks Hebrew, but they're taught Hebrew even more, the girls. So they're given a whole education. No, of course, Limudei Kodesh, but also a full Limudei Chol curriculum funded by the joint to a certain extent. iPad says, for me, the question is, do we use public money to maintain these items? Some universities have publicly funded now, have crosses built into them. Should public money be used to maintain these images, or as they decay, should they be removed? I think from my standpoint would be if it's like an old university and it has a cross in it, and now it's being publicly run, that's no longer religious. That's part of the historical element of it. So I would say you definitely keep them up. By the way, it also bothered me when I was at Harvard, there was you had pictures, for example, I think it was Pusey. I think he might have been the president. Or Lamont, I forget which one. Lamont, the one who is famous for keeping Jews out, you know, too many Jews. So there were pictures of him in one of the, Lamont, I think it was maybe Lamont, there's a library named after him. And I remember thinking that, you know what, it doesn't bother me anymore. You know, Jews are now at Harvard. If you want to have his picture up there, that to me doesn't bother me. It's, look, we've got to the point where Teddy Roosevelt's statue's down in New York, and they want to take Abraham Lincoln out, so I don't like it all. So I want to ask privately, is there, because the political pressure from the Arabs and the government about Gerba, I'm not sure what the question exactly was, so you can ask it again. iPad says Orthodoxy has survived, even thrived, but has also changed. Well, yes, in our little communities it has, but if you look at the broader picture, and if I tell you that less than 15% of the American Jewish community is Shomer Shabbos, is that really thriving? When you're living in Teaneck, when you're living in our communities, it looks very thriving, and it is. But on the other hand, if you go out to the heartland and you go where most Jews are, it's not thriving. Now, we'll continue to thrive. And soon there won't be many of them left, unfortunately. It is unfortunately, but that's the reality, because America is a place where if you're not connected, you easily intermarry. But I could see Geiger coming back and saying 15%. You think that's thriving? Thriving is 50%, 80% or something. It's not. So that says 19th century Warsaw. There weren't many Jews living in 18th century Warsaw. 18th century Vilna, I should say. 18th century Vilna was mostly Jewish. The majority of Vilna in the 18th century was Jewish. M.H. Lazenson, many conservative and reform institutions have posted signs on site saying abortion is a Jewish value. Yeah, I have to tell you, I'm very troubled by this, because even though I myself basically think pro-choice is the better movement for our community, at the end of the day, this does mean that all sorts of abortions are going to happen, which are not in accord with our values and halacha. And it's a strategic thing, I think, that I don't want government being involved in this, but to turn it into a value, a Jewish value, it's not a Jewish value. And it's a pagan idea that you can be pro-choice without saying a woman's body, her choice and all that, because these are pagan ideas. We don't believe it's our body. We don't believe you can have a tattoo. So and it's unfortunate that I think the conservative reform movement, instead of just using it, well, reform, they're not really part of any halachic system, but the conservative movement, which they so easily fell into this trap of using the progressive language, when you could have this, in other words, you could march and have a sign saying pro-choice, and you could be 100% pro-choice, but it doesn't mean you need to march and have a sign saying our body, our lives, or anything, making the essentially pagan argument that, which always I find astounding, because a lot of these women who are marching, making that point, as soon as they marry and are pregnant, then they put on the refrigerator the ultrasound, and they're so excited when they heard the heartbeat. But wait a second, I thought that it wasn't a life. We all know it's alive. Now, lots of things are alive. A dog's alive also, but we can kill a dog. So there are times when you can kill it, even if it is alive. But to make believe like it's not living, of course it's living. So I'm very disappointed in the conservative movement in particular, because Robert Gordas has a whole article on this talking about the pagan, my language here, the pagan idea comes rightly out of an article by Robert Gordas in Midstream Magazine, in which he spoke about this rhetoric and how it's we as Jews need to oppose it. And now his very movement has now adopted the very rhetoric. That helped explain perhaps why Gordas's grandson, Daniel Gordas, writes an article a few years ago in Joshua Books, A Requiem for the Conservative Movement, because basically everything conservative Judaism used to be has been forgotten. And many other conservative thinkers from the old school who made that point. And again, you could be 100% pro-choice. Even Ashram Patton told me that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was pro-choice, because he said they're going to get abortions anyway. And what do we, it's just going to make it worse. And you have plenty of rabbanim who think that it's not our job to get involved. This is not a Jewish issue. Let the American government deal with this. We want to have options for halachic abortions. And if Roe versus Wade is overturned in many states, you're not going to be able to get a halachically approved abortion. So now you might say, well, maybe that's a sacrifice we should give up, and so that all the other abortions, a million abortions a year, don't happen. But who says? It's the land of the free and the home of the brave here, religious freedom. Why should we get off our religious freedom? So there's arguments. It's an interesting debate. You can have the debate, but I wish conservatives had gone a different route. iPad says that B. Barry Levy says that in the Middle Ages, Sofer Minotaur texts conform to the Zohar. I wouldn't say amended the Torah text. The Zohar, and I don't remember the exact answer your exact example you're giving, but we have different reading traditions. The Zohar preserves certain texts read in a certain way that our texts don't have. But Rashi has certain texts that our texts don't have. We know that Sofrim at various times were like a guild. That is, according to halacha, this is the halacha by all the poskim. If you have a verse quoted in the Talmud and it's used for halachic reason, that is, they give a drash on it, and it's based upon the way it's spelled, then that's how it has to appear in our Torah texts. And yet our Torah texts do not have that. Our Torah texts do not follow that halacha, because the Sofrim were never led by the rabbis. The Sofrim had their own traditions, and that's why in every single Torah text we have now, it's in opposition to the halacha as appears in all the halachic texts. That is, they did not go in accordance with follow that if it's a drasha on halacha. They followed their own way, and this is now our Masoretic text. By the way, our text is not Rashi's text. There's a famous example in Bereishis where Rashi said, asks why there's this vav here and gives a drasha on it, and our text does not have the vav on that. And so there's a lot of discussion. You can read in Biberi Levi's book, Fixing God's Torah, and he uses the word fixing because of tikkun. That's what tikkun sofrim is. This whole idea of how the Torah text we have. I'll just mention something which is of interest because a lot of people get it wrong completely. A lot of people speak about the authenticity of our Torah because you can go everywhere in the world and there's like hardly any divergences. There's like nine changes, I think, and only two of them are deal with words, Vayu B'nei Noach, Vayu M'nei Noach, and also Daka is an Aleph or a Hey. And that's between the Yemenites and us. And they say that everywhere you go, the Torah text is the exact same, and that shows you the greatness of our tradition, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, the actual point is incorrect. I guarantee you, almost every Torah you pick up, you will find changes in it. How do I know this? Because the people who do computers, they claim that every Torah they put under a computer, even Torahs that have been read for 100 years, they found mistakes in them. Our Torah texts are full of mistakes, number one. Number two, even in terms of an actual version that we know what we want it to be, this was only possible with the rise of printing. Before you had printing, and then you had a one textus receptus, like one authoritative text, text Kubal, you had lots of different texts. In medieval Ashkenaz, for instance, you had lots of different texts. The differences are minuscule, tiny, but they're differences. And an extra vav here, an extra vav there, that according to Halacha, apostles the Torah. The question is, well, which is the one? Diavad, it wouldn't apostle it because we're not bucky on Mali and Chaser, according to almost everyone. It wouldn't apostle it, but we have other ones as well, other changes in the text. It's only with the rise of printing. We have Masoretic works, beginning in particular with Rameir Halevi's work, Mesora Siago Torah. He tells us that there are so many different versions, we have to have the correct one, and then you have the Mincha Shai, and you have Menachem Manzano's work, and finally there was a printing, and it was the Mikros Gedolos, and that then became the text, which all Sofrim began to copy from. But before you had that, there was all sorts of different traditions with small differences, and this isn't speculation. We have Sifrei Torah from these periods, and we can see that. But it's to be expected because mistakes eventually over time then become a quote tradition. So by the you needed the Mincha Shai and you needed Rav Menachem Manzano to look at the best manuscripts and put together what they thought was the best text. And I tell you now, it's not even the best text. The Yemenites have the better text because the Yemenite text is in line with the Aleppo Codex. And Rameir Halevi Abulafia, the Ramah, he says that he doesn't have the Rambam's text. He didn't call it the Aleppo Codex, but the Rambam refers to this text. And because he doesn't have this text, he tells us in the introduction that he's going to take the best Ashkenazic and the best, the best Sephardic texts. So he's going to take the best Sephardic texts, and out of that, he's going to come up with the best one. And then if you continue down the road, that's what they were doing, and they came up with a text. And the Aleppo Codex is not the identical. Although we're missing on Torah, the Aleppo Codex, we have testaments to what was in there. But basically, we can say what the text should be. But throughout history, many people did not have that because different traditions developed. And the fact remains that in the Talmud, we have different versions of the text. So that's just the way it is. But that's this is a halachic matter like anything else. Nissen says, the last Mishnah tractate Arachin mandates abortion in the ninth month. Well, it's the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, it's not Arachin, it's Olos.
I'm speaking of the case of Inui Hadin, about the Isha Hayoseh Sehorek, who has drawn into labor.
Yes, and that's another proof that it's not human life, because if they say if it's human life, I think you're referring to Olos, where she's actually giving birth.
That's something else. That's the classical.
So, in fact, Rav Yaakov Emden, he claimed that, therefore, a woman who committed adultery and got pregnant because we would execute her if we had a basement, just therefore you can do the abortion. Yes.
Within Nam Yom. Rabbi Black taught me that in one of his earlier works from decades ago.
Yes.
But there it's Nam Yom. It's interesting why he doesn't seem to extend it.
What'd you say? What did he say?
That's Toch Mem Yom when he says it's Mayo Bi Alma. The only Avera would be Hashchasas Zera.
Yaakov
Emden, right.
Okay.
Yaakov Emden.
But by the way, it's not clear if there's any prohibition other than Hashchasa or other things, Toch Mem Yom, and we know that we have all sorts of lenient positions. Rav Vad Yosef would permit in all sorts of reasons. But yes, so thank you for reminding me of that. But Rav Schechter was talking about a case where it was a tzorech gadol, not a mandate abortion. And he said even in the ninth month. Mark says, isn't Bereishit also construct? Yeah, but how would you spell it? That's the word. So with Bamidbar and with Shemot, you would actually spell it differently. So you don't have the issue with Bereishit. iPad says we don't formally mourn a child who dies within 30 days. That is true, but we don't say we still regard it as a human life. You can't kill it or anything like that. It's we don't give it mourning, but you can't kill it. So Lazarson said, should the Russians have removed the statue of Stalin and Lenin? That's different because it's so much closer to the time, and those statues meant oppression and control of people lived under this. We're not talking about like if a statue 500 years ago, that's like saying taking a statue from the Tsar from 400 years ago and removing it. That's, if they were to find in 500 years from now, if they find a statue underneath some snow of Stalin, then it would be, something. And by the way, it's still dangerous. They were marching in London yesterday. These leftists, they were saying Castro, Che Guevara, Stalin. So that people want to bring him back. Lowell. Well, thank you. It's Lowell. That was the president of Harvard. And the Jewish demography of in Gerba, it's 1,200 Jews, all Shomer Shabbos. Lots of children. The question was about political pressure from the government that the Gerba community is opposed to Zionism and making Aliyah. Absolutely not. Don't go there yourself. You'll see. You sit around the Shabbos table, I would ask everyone, why not go to Israel? And the same answer from everyone. We saw what happened when they went to Israel. And the rabbis wrote back saying, don't come. And Yitzhak Yosef was there a few years ago. He told them, don't go to Israel. These are typical Sephardic, they wear jeans, t-shirts, right? But the only cultures on the island are the Arab culture and the Jewish culture. And the Jewish culture is Shomer Shabbos and religious. So by definition, they're in a religious community. They go to Israel immediately, then there'd be another Jewish culture, and half of them would drop out. And they saw that happen because in after this 1948, many Jews from Gerba went to Israel, and they became Masoreti or completely irreligious. There's one name he went in the 70s. His name is Rafram Chadad. You can look him up. He's a world-renowned artist. And the idea that a Jew from Gerba would not be religious, it's unheard of. And yet Menachem Mazuz, you heard of Menachem Mazuz, wasn't he attorney general in Israel? This comes from the most yichustik family, if I can use the word yichustik to refer to a Sephardic family, the most yichustik family in all of Tunisia, Rav Mazuz. If you've been with me for so long, that's Rav Mazuz's first cousin. He comes from the Rabbanim Gedoli Yisrael. This never, ever happened, just like it never happened in Yemen. I mean, how many Yemenite murders you've had in Israel now? I heard with my own ears, I heard Menachem Meir Kahana say, and he was a big Zionist, you can't deny this. He said, in 2,000 years in Yemen, you never had one Jewish murderer, and now we have in Yemen, and now we have all of them because of what, and his point was of what the secularists did to them. But I'm telling you, it's an amazing thing that the community, they send their kids on birthright. There's a special birthright from the kids of Gerba. It's the only birthright in the world that's in Hebrew because they all know Hebrew, and it's run, and they run it in a very special way. Obviously, boys separate, girls separate. But nevertheless, there is a lot of fear, and all the people I spoke to, the kids stay in the community, and the community is expanding. They keep expanding the Erev, and they don't want their kids to go to Israel because they're afraid they won't remain religious. And so my son, who is with me, he's starting Moshavah next week as a counselor again. I said, go there and speak to the people of Moshava. You know, the Moshava types, they're all B'nai Akiva. The idea is if you're not living in Israel, you know, you're half a Jew and everyone should be in Israel. So he's going to ask them, what about, here's the reality. If these young people go to Israel, guaranteed at least half of them will become not halachic, completely halachic. Should they still come to Israel? Let's see what they tell the Moshava. Ellen says, we'll go for 5 more minutes. Ellen says, in the intro to the Haketer, Uriel Menachem notes, no, his name is not Uriel Menachem. I forget his name, the editor of it. Check the name again. It's not, his name is escaping, you know, but it's not Uriel Menachem. Notes that other editions edits Rashi's Dibur Ma'atchilim to conform to our text, but he doesn't. Okay, Dibur Ma'atchilim is a different issue. That's the last point. Let me just say one more thing before we end. Because I said that it's not, I want to give you the name of him, Menachem HaKohen. That's who it is. Not Uriel Menachem, Menachem HaKohen. Okay, thank you all.
That's just how we know, one of the ways we know that Rashi had a different text is from the manuscripts, you know that. And then everybody has managed to wipe it out.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, so I misunderstood what you were saying. Yes, absolutely. Sometimes, exactly. That's the example the example I gave, he explains it in a note, but you're right. Absolutely. That's the Dibur Ma'atchil could tell us that. Again, these differences are minuscule. An extra vav, maybe an extra yud. This is what the Gemara speaks about when it says that you can't count it. They said, bring out the Torah, we can count it, so we know what's the middle. We're not Bucky and Malay and Chaser. But the thing is that the Gemara often has drushes, dafka on these vavs. So the question is then, if you learn a halacha on it, according to the Radbaz and all the halachic sources, our Sefer Torah should reflect the drasha, but it doesn't. So why doesn't it? Well, if you want to read this, read Schneer Lyman's article. I think it's called, you can get it on the Lyman Library, Halacha and History, something like that. It's a whole article as to why Halacha did not win out over the Sofrim. And on this issue, and it's everything Schneer Lyman writes, it's a beautiful read. So I encourage you all to check it out. And thank you for spending the night with me tonight. I hope my voice wasn't so bad. It's helping me get out of COVID, learning Torah and talking to all of you. And thank you for your comments.
Dr. Mark, is Menachem HaKohen the Chaver Knesset from Obed Hadatzim?
No. He's Menachem HaKohen is a biblical scholar. Menachem HaKohen, the Chaver Knesset, who's got to be, how old is he now?
He was a man that Menachem Begin called a Rav Matam.
Yes, Menachem HaKohen was a member of for many. Okay. He's born in 1932, so he's 89. I just checked it. He's the father of Aviad HaKohen, as the dean of one of the law schools and a scholar. He was always the rabbi in the labor movement, but he's also the brother of Pinchas Peli and also Shmuel Avidor. So they're of good families, but it's completely different people. And
Dr. Mark, after you left our class, did an interview in my class and chat today. So the kids it's the second last day of the year. They wanted to discuss biblical criticism a little bit, you know, because I once mentioned class, we never discussed it. Anyways, but I pointed out among the things we discussed is, of course, the Rabbi Akiva Eger on Shabbos Nun Hey Amud Beit, where Rabbi Akiva Eger lists off about 25 places where our Sefer Torah is different from the Sefer Torah in the Gemara. Like you were saying, all the drushot, Sukkot. Yeah. Various threshold, and Rabbi Akiva Eger just collects them. Says, yeah. Or it says this, our Torah is
the best. Rav Chaim Hirschenson has a tshuva on biblical criticism, and he says, and people forget this, you have to distinguish between lower criticism and higher criticism. Lower criticism is so free, make mistakes. There's different versions. That, he says, is Limud Torah. Higher criticism, that's the theological issue, the problem, different documents, and that's where you get to Yehuda Chassid, And biblical criticism today is much more than documents, because that already, maybe you can argue, Huda Chassid, they're talking in terms of that the author of Deuteronomy had a different theological conception in Exodus, and it contradicts it. So that's something totally different. But Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson says explicitly, like Rabbi Akiva Eger, that this is Limud Torah. Now, for Halacha, we can only write a Sefer Torah one way, but he says that if you want to suggest, like we saw the Vilna Gaon, you know, like does with the explanations, that this is what the text should say, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with suggesting that maybe the original text was this, but halacha l'maaseh, we have to write it this way. I'm not saying you should go into your local yeshiva and start suggesting it, but that's what he says, and that's what you have. I gave in the Limits of Orthodox Theology an example where the Or HaChaim, he mentions, whatever, it's for a discussion for a different time, but Shmuel Ashkenazi, that great bibliophile who passed away, he gave an example where all the ancient texts, the Or HaChaim asks a question, why the text of the Torah reads a certain way, and he gives a drush type of answer. And Shmuel Ashkenazi says, the different version is found in the Targumim, it's found in all the translations, and he says that really it could be that what we have in our Masoretic text is not the authentic version, but that's whatever, that's the version we have. This is published in one of the rabbinic journals in Israel. Next week, I'll show it to you, actually, so people will find it interesting. Yeah.
Okay, it's late. We wish everybody a good night. Tomorrow, Dr. Tova Genzel is beginning her 7-part series. I invite everybody to that. 12 noon on from the end of the kingdom of Yehuda to the beginning of the return to Zion, sort of the later books in Tanakh, tomorrow at noon. And then at 1:30, Lori Novak continues on learning Talmud with Levinas. So that's tomorrow, 12 and 1:30, kind of almost back to back. And then Thursday, Shuli Mishkin, as I sent out before, will be giving class. She announced last week she couldn't, but she will be giving the class today, Thursday at 12. That is after Daniel Lester's class on Charism, finishing of series on Charism. So look forward to learning with you. Then the Parsha Thursday night, Aaron Greenberg, my share in the Siddur Friday. And we look forward to learning Marty Lection Wednesday morning. So look forward to learning with you. Invite a friend and everybody have a Laila Tov and good night. And thank you very much and be well. Thank you, Laila Tov.